we won't go, boy. Welcome here to my side. I'm from the people of the snow, boy. That mean I thrive in the wintertime. Yeah, I'm what they call a savage kid. My family tree is bigger than the Old and New Testament. I put a fist up. That's where they're calling Kaepernick. Somebody gotta stand for it.
Tell them who you are.
So beware, we black snake killers. Black fish, I've been a killer. We're the ones you can't get rid of. Sound familiar? Yeah, long hair, that Ric Flair. Nature boy from the village. G.E. for really, really, you see. I don't rock and roll. Nah, I stand and rock. Yeah, I think there's something in the water. Here's some food for thought. Is it really a fair need for wanting my water clean? Expect it's not the rage against the machine. Ain't moving like Rosa P. Nope. You know why? Cause this dream catcher ain't catching your pipe dream. Word. Look what happened to Flint. No disrespect, but the same thing happens to village kids that see water from the tap and are dying to live from the cancer it gives. Where's the state of emergency for them?
I don't know.
Act like you know the story. Broken treaties, unholy matrimony. One nation, under the creator, homie. All my relations, many with Choney.
Warriors, come out and play. Officer.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
The leaves are falling, the birds are chirping, and KBOO's fall membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at kboo.fm/give between now and September 21st and support independent airwaves.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. From Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. On today's program, Sacred Stage talks with Native playwrights and artists with Delana Studi. We'll speak with her on the 30th anniversary of Native Voices at the Autry in Los Angeles, California, one of the longest-running theater and arts programs for Native American artists. All that and more here on American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone duel in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the Bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching.
Today on American Indian Airwaves Sacred Stage talks with Native playwrights and artists with Delana Studi. Delana Studi is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and an accomplished performer, storyteller, playwright, and activist for over 25 years. Some of her theater credits include, to name just a few, the first national Broadway tour of Tony Award and Pulitzer Prize winning play, August Osage County, Off-Broadway's Gloria, A Life, and Informed Consent. In addition, Delana originated roles in over 30 world premieres, including writing and performing in And So We Walked, An Artist's Journey Along the Trail of Tears, where she retraced her family's footsteps along the Trail of Tears with her father. In film and television, Delana starred in the Peabody Award-winning Edge of America, Hallmark's Dreamkeeper, Goliath, Shameless, General Hospital, Disney Plus's Launchpad the Roof, and Reservation Dogs. She has served as a cultural liaison for theater, film, and television, most recently the television series La Brea. Delana has been the chair of the SAG-AFTRA National Native Americans Committee since 2007. She is also the artistic director of Native Voices at the Autry, the only equity theater in the country developing and producing plays written by Native American playwrights. Our guest for today, Delana Studi, joins us to discuss, as her role as the artistic director of Native Voices at the Autry, based out of Los Angeles, California, the multi-coalition Generation Now Theater Partnership, which is comprised of BIPOC artists whose artistic creations cross through multi-generational audiences, and the celebration this year of the 30th anniversary of Native Voices at the Autry and its continuing legacy for providing Native American artists and aspiring artists a space in theater and the arts. All that and more today here on American Indian Airwaves. And now we begin our interview on Sacred Stage Talks with Native Playwrights and Artists with Delana Studi on what is the Generation Now Theater Partnership.
Generation Now is generously funded by the Mellon Foundation, and they reached out to Native Voices. It was through the Children's Theater Company out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is probably the most renowned children's theater company in the country. They have done so many beautiful work that have continued on to Broadway and have even won Tonys. And so they reached out to Native Voices to see if we'd want to be part of this cohort. And so it was through this conversation with Peter Brocious, who is now the retired artistic director of the Children's Theater Company, that we were able to get involved. And it was the very first Mellon grant the Autry's ever received, and I'm happy to say it all came through Native Voices. So what this grant allows us to do is we're working in a multicultural cohort that consists of Native Voices. It's also the Latino Theater Company, also of Los Angeles, at Penumbra, which is a black theater company out of Minneapolis, and MAI, which is an Asian American theater company out of New York. And we are going to be creating intergenerational plays. So we each received money to commission and workshop four new plays. Three are what we call straight plays, which is they're just plays as you know them, and one is a musical, which is very exciting. And it's the first time ever that the commissions are somewhat, they're rather significant. In the history of Native Voices, we haven't been able to do a lot of commissions, and when we do commissions, it's usually in, you know, a four-number range. You know, it's like they get maybe $2,000 to $3,000, sometimes maybe five, depending. But for Generation Now, we're able to commission our full-length straight plays for $15,000 and our musicals for $25,000, which is very exciting. And so basically, we ask playwrights from across the United States and Canada and even abroad, as long as they're in, you know, Native American. We actually have a Cherokee writer that's in Belgium that will submit a proposal. But all they have to do is submit a proposal. It will be read by several of us, and then we'll have deep conversations about it. And then we'll call the playwrights or playwright, sometimes if they have a partner, and we'll do a callback session where we ask them to dream about the play and what they want it to be. And so since the playwrights come to us with just a proposal, we help them develop the play from start to finish. It gets a workshop in Los Angeles, but it also gets a workshop at the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis. And ideally, we're hoping that all of the plays, all 16 in total, will be produced both on our main stage and then also on the main stage at the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis. So that's what Generation Now is. Under Peter Brocious' leadership, we were able to commission two new plays. We have Dustin Timacara's Comanche Girl on the Moon, and we have our musical, which is The Mainlanders by Kalani Kwepo and his writing partner, Chadwick Johnson. We have a new artistic director at the Children's Theater Company, and that is Rick Dildine. And under Rick, we'll commission the last two. So you should be seeing proposals, a call for proposals going out I would say by the end of the year, which is very exciting.
Delana, for our audiences, can you talk a little bit about who Dustin and Kalani, who they are and their contributions in the theater, arts, film, and even Indigenous scholarship?
Yes. So Dustin Tabakara is all of those things and more. We actually knew him as in his scholarship role. He's a professor at OU University here in Oklahoma, so the University of Oklahoma in Norman. And he's been working with the Autry Museum for a very long time, contributing to different exhibits, providing critique, and also, educational information. And so he submitted to our short play festival when I first became artistic director of Native Voices, which was in 2020. Our very first play back in the space after we had been shut down was... the theme was home, and Dustin submitted a beautiful short play that was, I think, less than 6 minutes long, called Comancheria 911, and it was incredible. In fact, it won that year's prize, and that's how we became aware of who Dustin was as a writer and not just as a scholar. And so when this first proposal came out, we received, oh my goodness, so many exciting ideas for us for plays, but Dustin's is the one that just won us over. And then we called him into the room to have a conversation, and Dustin was literally dreaming about this world. He had already spent so much time just writing it, and we knew that even if we didn't choose his piece, it was a piece that was going to be, he was going to continue writing it. But because it was such a beautiful proposal and his presentation, we were sold from the very beginning. So basically, Comanche Girl on the Moon is about a young Native girl. That's the thing about these intergenerational plays, is we want all the leads to be young people. And so it's a 13-year-old Native girl that is neurodivergent. Her best friend and honestly the only parent she has in the world was her grandma. And her grandma dies. And so... her uncle comes into the picture, and he wants to take the family's homelands. And so it's her fight to save her ancestral home. And because she's neurodivergent and because she doesn't really have any friends and she's been picked on by the kids at school, her closest friends are her rabbit and other animals in the area. And so they all rally together to save the family home. And one of the stories that Peta, which is the main character's name, Peta, her grandmother told her was about how there was a time when humans could understand animals and animals could understand humans, and there was a time when Comanche women could fly to the moon. And so I'm getting all emotional just talking about it. Peta finds her inner strength, and she's able to fly to the moon and save her family's home. It's really just a beautiful story about strength, resilience, family, identity, but at the end of the day, it's about a young person finding the power within themselves to make big changes, and especially this young neurodivergent girl who I feel like our young people that are neurodivergent, they never get to see themselves accurately portrayed, and when we do see them on television or film or in theater, they're never the hero of the story, so to be able to tell the story this way, it was really meaningful to all of us. And so that's Comanche Girl on the Moon. And then Kalani Kwepo and Chadwick Johnson have written this beautiful musical called The Mainlanders. And it's about a young Hawaiian child. I forgot to mention, Dustin is Comanche and Kalani Kwepo is a Native Hawaiian. And so it's about this, so Kalani's play, The Mainlanders, is about this young man named Kimu. Kimu, who's, I want to say he's 9, maybe 10 years old. And... he comes from a broken home. His parents divorced when he was younger. He's never really met his father. His father really doesn't want to have a lot to do with him. And so he and his mom moved to the mainland to create this relationship with his father. But because his father still is being an absent father, Kimo and his mother decided to move back to Hawaii to be with her family. But while he was in on the mainland, he developed this stutter just because he didn't feel his self-worth. And so when he gets to when he leaves the mainland and gets to Hawaii, he's dealing with the stutter it's a psychosomatic event to what has happened to him. He arrives at the mainland with his mother, arrives from the mainland to Hawaii with his mother at the same time that his uncle, which is his mother's brother, is also coming back from the mainland because he was released from prison. And so it's a beautiful story about these two young men, you know, his uncle, Kavika, and Kimo, this, you know, 9-year-old boy, and how they're acclimating to returning back to Hawaii after being on the mainland for so long, how they confront their past demons, and also how do they find their voices and feel like they are enough. And it's just a beautiful show. It has a lot of fun. It reminds me a lot of the relationship to the uncle and the young boy. Reminds me a lot of what happens in To Kill a Mockingbird with Boo Radley. Mm. You know, he comes back to Hawaii, and everyone has ideas about why he was in prison on the mainland. And of course, they're far-fetched and outrageous. But when you're a 9-year-old boy, they're terrifying. And so, you know, he's learning to have a conversation with him and also with his peers. And because it's a musical, you know, there's music involved that we're still working on. But that's the story. It's how he's able to find his voice through the traditional Hawaiian songs and that he learned from his uncle.
And Delana, for our listeners, talk a little bit about who Kalani is. He's a well-versed artist and accomplished actor, but give us a sense of his contributions, if you will, to the arts.
Oh, yeah. So Kalani Kwepo he's a phenomenal actor. Most people will probably recognize him most as an actor. He's a newer playwright. He's written, I want to say, 3 plays. 2 of them have been musicals. But Kalani was on Saints and Strangers, where he played Squanto. And then he also was on Jamestown, which was on the BBC, and he played Chakro. And then one of my favorite roles of Kalani was most recently where he was on Trickster, where he played Wade on Trickster, and he actually received, the Canadian
Screen Award.
Yes, well, he's a nomination for Best Supporting Actor for that. He ended up losing to Christopher Plummer, but I was like, if you're going to lose to someone, Christopher Plummer is one to lose to. but Kalani is just a phenomenal actor. And one of my favorite things about him is, you know, I've worked with Kalani for a very long time at Native Voices. And, you know, he's worked, and I feel like if you're a Native Voices family member, if you've worked with us at all, you've learned how to, especially as an actor, you learn how to be in the process of helping us develop these new plays. So you learn about asking questions, you learn a little bit about dramaturgy, a little bit about directing, and of course all about performing. But it was through having these conversations at Native Voices that he was able to write his first play, and it was selected to be one of our plays for the Festival of New Plays, I want to say back in 2019.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. You're listening to our ongoing series, Sacred Stage, Talks with Native Playwrights and Artists with Delana Studi. She's speaking on the 30th anniversary of Native Voices at the Autry and the Generation Now Theater Project. All that and more here on American Indian Airwaves. And now back to the interview.
It was a beautiful musical called Missing Piece, and that's when I fell in love with Kalani as a playwright, because it was the first time I'd ever seen anything that he had written. And he's so masterful of the language, and because of his work as an actor, he knows good storylines and what a dramatic arc is, and he can really find the nuances of a character and uplift a story. So I'm very excited to see where he and his writing partner, Chadwick Johnson, go with this. So it's an exciting journey to be on. It's our newest commission, so it's still in process, just like Dustin's is. I feel like Dustin's is a little bit further because Dustin's had a year longer to work on his piece than Kalani and Chadwick. But I'm excited to see where it goes. And right now, the way it's developing nicely, and I have huge plans for it. So fingers are crossed for both of them, because I'm so proud of both of these plays, and they excite me, and I can't wait for them to be fully staged hopefully in a theater near you.
Delana, I share the sentiment with both individuals, and certainly, you know, Dustin's academic scholarship I'm familiar with, and Kalani, I've had the honor and pleasure to meet there at the Autry at several events over the years. And I know you've been talking about, their projects in development or in process. And again, for our listeners, can you give us a sense of what that timeline might look like, and then where you hope to see their artistic creations performed at theaters?
Yeah, so ideally, if everything goes according to plan, and I'm leery of even saying that since COVID happened, because nothing ever goes to plan anymore. But they will, both of them will be on the stage of Native Voices, which nice. Means that will be either at the Autry stage there at the museum. We've also been doing a lot of co-productions outside of the Autry. For example, this year our fall production is going to be on another Autry campus, which was once known as the Southwest Museum. And so, you know, in the past we've also partnered with the Latino Theater Company.
Right.
So it depends on who we get to help us co-produce this, if it will be on our stage, which has been always at the Autry, or if it will be at a bigger venue outside of the Autry. But ideally, they will both be produced by Native Voices, and they will also be both produced by the Children's Theater Company. And so as for when they'll be produced, you know, like I said, we're still in the development process of them. Dustin's play has received, it's going to be receiving its second workshop in October this year.
Nice.
So we'll know a little bit more after that workshop about how close we are to a production. Kalani's and Chadwick's has received one production this year, and that was back in March. And we're still in the process of, you know, providing feedback and dramaturgical notes and support. And so we'll see where that goes. But if I had my druthers, you would see these as early as 2026.
Nice.
And because of hopefully fall of 2026, if I had my druthers. I don't want to overpromise something, but that's where I would like things to happen.
You mentioned the significance of the funding, and I know the political economy of media and theater arts plays a very profound role. And I guess to kind of step back to that and kind of the uniqueness of Generation Now and the work that the Autry is doing in collaboration, talk about again how this impacts like the two projects we're talking about, you know, and how meaningful it is for Native Voices and just Native people working in theater arts, in the arts, to have that kind of financial support, as well as other complementary resources in storytelling.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like, you know, in today's economy and also today's society and what's happening politically, the first thing that always gets cut is our arts education.
Right.
And that's just, it's so saddening to me because that's what we need the most, especially in these difficult times. You know, recently, I want to say it was voted down just yesterday, they were trying to cut a lot of money from, and by a lot of money, I mean like millions upon millions of dollars from the NEA and the NEH, the National Endowment of the Arts and for Humanities, and those were voted down, thank goodness. But, you know, arts, if I were to speak from my own personal experience, I would say the art world, especially theater arts, saved my life. I was, I grew up in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma. I had severe social anxiety. I was probably one of the shyest people you'll ever meet. I still have moments of that, don't get me wrong, but it was my father making me take speech and debate because Cherokee women are meant to be speakers, they're meant to be leaders, and so he wanted me to live up to my full potential as a Cherokee woman. And I remember just resenting him so much for making me take these terrible classes. But it was through taking speech, debate, and drama that I was able to find my voice. I was able to finally be able to articulate what was happening to me and inside of me using a playwright's words, right? I was able to find my voice by hiding behind a character. And I think there's something really powerful about going to a play and seeing someone that resembles you, that looks like you, that has your same background, telling a powerful story. You get to see them as a fully fledged human person that is the hero of a show. And it really changed how I look at myself. It changed my confidence level. It changed so much about me. And I'm so grateful that because of my experience in the theater world, that I now have this opportunity to do that for other young people who may not be able to see themselves reflected back to them on stage or screen. And so for me, you know, being able to take these stories, you know, I jokingly say I get to be Oprah for a moment. I get to help make people's dreams come true. And in most of the cases, especially with these playwrights, you know, they have an idea of what the play is in their head, but then we put them with designers and we put them with a director. And of course we bring amazing actors to the table for them, and it ends up surpassing even their wildest dreams, right? Because if you are not a theater professional, you know, you have a very limited idea of what can be done on stage, but when you have people that this is what they do for a living, they bring so many more layers to it, and pretty soon, you know, it's, I was very happy that Dustin has written this play about this young woman who learns to fly, and we will be able to do that on stage because that's mm-hmm. something that we can do. That's the beauty of, you know, theater magic, my friend. And so I'm so excited about being able to, you know, take playwrights, give them an opportunity to tell their story, and then we introduce them to designers. They find out what can actually be done on a stage. And usually the next draft is they're dreaming bigger, and it just makes me so happy because I feel, you know, since the arts are usually the first thing to be cut, a lot of our artists have learned to dream small because we're used to doing things on a shoestring budget. Right. And so we don't really allow ourselves to dream big like we used to. And now we're able to see them really shine and really, you know, think of these amazing ideas. And now it's our job to figure out how to make them come true, which is so exciting. I don't know if that really answers the question, or if that was just me gushing about the process and about why I think arts are important.
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly, and that's why I asked the question. I think it's so important, and you know, with Indigenous, you know, traditions, right? Storytelling so important, and theater and arts, and the opportunities that future and current Native playwrights and actors and actresses that want to work in the theater arts, having those spaces and those resources is so important, and allows, you know, that tradition of storytelling to continue on in different ways. And that's so that's why I asked that question. But also, in follow-up to your response and talking about how theater and arts was so personal for you, and I know this might be uncomfortable, but for our listeners, you have a very long, successful legacy of contributions and work in the theater, in arts, and in film, but also with SAG-AFTRA, and I can continue to go on and on, but maybe expand upon that journey where your uncle had you take that first class, and what that journey has been like in leading up to your role at the Autry.
Oh yes, well, you know, oh goodness. Okay, that's a good question. So, yeah, because I was, you know, I was scared of my own shadow. I was that child that would not speak unless I was spoken to, and then you had to like really, like ask me a question at least 7 times before I would respond because I was just terrified. And so, it was honestly debilitating just the way I was, just so my shyness and anxiety levels. And so, when my father made me take these classes in. Oh, gosh, he picked out all my electives in 9th grade. And so I was forced to take these classes, and I was forced to excel at them whether I wanted to or not. And I remember, you know, that's the first time I felt like I was good at something, if that makes any sense. It was, yeah. And it was, as a shy person, it became something very easy for me just because I was able to hide behind a character. And if people didn't like that character, well, that's not me. That's the character they don't like, you know. So there was right. something really freeing about being able to hide behind that, you know, a character that was written by someone else. And it's something that it really stuck with me. And so even when I went to college to be an engineer, I was still taking classes, you know, in the theater, just because it was my escape. It was my way I could find words for myself to articulate my experience. It was a way to be in community and to collaborate and feel like my voice was heard and needed. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, after I spoke to my Uncle Wes and told him I wanted to do this, he suggested I move to L.A. and give it a shot. And so I moved to L.A., and my father's rules were always, wherever you go, know whose land you're on. Mm. And when you find the native folks, you'll find home. And so that's what I did. I moved to Los Angeles. I found a Tongva elder who basically took me in and became like a surrogate papa to me when I was away from my papa. Mm. And I found Native Voices, and I found home. And I started at Native Voices as an assistant director And then I became an actor on their stage. And it was through working as an actor that I was able to be part of that new play development that I mentioned earlier. And I learned the questions to ask. I learned what made a good play better. I learned, you know, about dramatic arcs and, you know, storytelling and the amazing ways that Native school, the way we tell stories and how it doesn't really feel that Aristotelian structure and how that was okay. And not just okay, it was actually even better than being okay because our structure predates that structure. And so being able to find, you know, that pride in the way we tell stories and to find ways to get these stories on the stage was very exciting to me. And then I always jokingly say I was voluntold to become the chair of the SAG-AFTRA Native American Committee. It was through Marjorie Tannen, who is an amazing woman, beloved elder, just a fierce female that if I could be half the person that Marjorie Tannen is, I would be the luckiest person in the entire world. So she voluntold me to be the chair, and so I said, yes, ma'am, because that's what you do when an elder tells you to do something. And so we were able to make changes on the other side of the table, like how our people are treated when they're on set, and how do we ensure that, you know, they're not being taken advantage of and that their voices are amplified and heard. And I remember just being so frustrated with the roles that were offered to me as a Native woman, and I always felt like as a Native woman, the roles that were being offered by Hollywood, I was always being either victimized or pushed off to the background. And I wanted to be able to do a role where I felt like I didn't have to sacrifice my culture or my gender, because I always feel like those two could not exist in the writing that these non-Native folks are submitting to me to act in. So I realized I could keep complaining about the problem and keep hoping that someone would write a good part for me, or else I could do something about it and start writing myself. And so it was using the skills I learned at Native Voices and my frustration with everything that I was seeing as an actor in Hollywood that I became a playwright. I wrote my first play. Nice. It went through the Short Play Festival. It ended up being a finalist. In fact, it's still being performed in workshops in short play festivals around the country right now, which is nice. Exciting. Nice. Even though I wrote that like 15 years ago or something ridiculous. And then because I went through that process, I realized, okay, I can do this. So I wrote my own play, and so we walked, and it was developed through Native Voices. So I've gone through that process of being a playwright at Native Voices through both the Short Play Festival and the Festival of New Plays. And before we even did the workshop at Native Voices, it was already selected to be produced outside of town, which was very exciting. Mm-hmm. In fact, before I even had written a single word, there were people out there that believed in what I was doing and were willing to invest in it without having seen a single word. And so nothing will light a fire under you than that, trust me. Now I have to write this play, and it better be good. It's going to be produced this fall, so let's get going.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. You're listening to our ongoing series, Sacred Stage, Talks with Native Playwrights and Artists with Delana Studi. She's speaking on the 30th anniversary of Native Voices at the Autry and the Generation Now Theater Project. All that and more here on American Indian Airwaves. And now back to the interview.
And so it was through going through all the steps at Native Voices, you know, that I was able to get the career that I have now, both as an actor and as a writer. And then when Randy Reinholds, who was the founder and the director, the first artistic director and the founder of Native Voices, when he and his wife, Jean Bruce Scott, who was also a founder and the executive director of Native Voices, when they were retiring, they were looking for someone to take over. And so I remember just getting a call when I was in North Carolina working on another play. And Randy was like, where's your resume? Where's your cover letter? We didn't get your application. And I was like, oh, yeah, because I didn't apply. And he's like, why did you not apply? And I was like, well, I don't think I'm qualified for the job. And he's like, no, trust me, you are qualified for this job. You know Native Voices in and out. You've gone through all the process. You've been an actor, assistant director. You've been a playwright, worked with dramaturgs. You've been a dramaturg. You know, you know this. And so it was through his urging that I actually applied for the position, and I ended up getting, I go back to acting terms. I don't want to say the callback. But I got the second interview, and then after the second interview, I got the third and final interview, right, where I had to actually speak to the powers that me at the Autry. And I ended up, you know, getting this position. And so in a weird way, and I always joke, you know, how we Indians, we love circles. I have come full circle at the Autry. I am now able to provide people the opportunities that I so wanted when I was younger. And also able to take what Randy and Jean have built so beautifully and build upon that so I can provide, you know, more opportunities. And I know that whoever comes after me will take what I have built and build even more. You know, it's a beautiful, it's a beautiful circle. That's just, you know, it's, I'm just so excited to see what the next generation for Native Voices will be like. Not that I'm in any way getting ready to retire, let's be clear, but I do know that the next generation is going to bring so much more than I even dreamed possible. So I'm very grateful that Jean and Randy have entrusted me with their vision and their legacy, and honestly, their baby, because that's what this was. It was just a little dream. And the fact that this year we are celebrating our 30th anniversary, it's such an exciting win for us, just for Native art in general, and so many other, or I won't even say Native theaters, but so many other theaters across the country have fallen since COVID. The fact that we are still here and we are growing and we're able to celebrate our 30th anniversary, it's such a monumental occasion. I'm just so blessed and lucky.
And when is the 30th anniversary?
Well, we were going to be celebrating it with our Festival of New Plays, and that's going to be August 9th is when we're going to have it. We're going to be showcasing two Native playwrights, and we'll have a reception between those readings, but those will be on August 9th. And I believe we'll be doing the readings Friday, August 9th is when we'll present at the Autry. And I want to say Sunday, August 11th is when we'll be presenting both plays at La Jolla Playhouse in San Diego.
Is that Feast for the Dead that you're referring to for the August 9th?
Both of them. So we're going to do Maddie Easley's Feast for the Dead, August 9th, and also Jennifer Bobby Wash's Never Say Die. So those will both be on August 9th. Never Say Die is going to happen at 3 p.m. And then we're going to have a 6 p.m. reception to celebrate our 30th anniversary. And then Feast for the Dead is going to go up at 7 p.m. that night. And then, of course, they will both move to La Jolla Playhouse on Sunday. Never Say Die will be at noon in La Jolla in San Diego. There will be another reception at 3, and then Feast for the Dead will be at 4 o'clock at La Jolla on Sunday the 11th.
In listening to you respond to my prior questions, in your life's journey and your life's experiences, you've really transitioned and moved between film, television, theater, and arts, our cultural liaison. You have this very instrumental and important and highly responsible role at the Autry. And I was curious, you said you started your journey in film. You know, we can talk about the legacy of first cinema or Hollywood cinema and the Hollywood Indian and how it's so problematic and still is in many ways. And maybe you can speak to some of the inroads and the successes in Hollywood. And maybe start with your first experience in a role where you felt like you didn't have to give up, you know, who you are as a Cherokee woman.
Oh my! I've been very lucky that I feel like a lot of the parts I've received and I've been able, you know, to play, it's because of relationships that I had made before I even got the part. If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And so I find that's a lot. That's very true for a lot of the work that I get. It's, you know, I've worked really hard to build. You know, I don't want to say the word reputation, but I've worked really hard to build what I would consider, I hate the word reputation, but we'll use it anyway. Yeah. I've worked really hard to be approachable, to be a person that comes in, not with problems, but also with solutions. You know, my father always said, it's good to point out the problems, but you also should have ideas about how to fix them if you're going to point them out. And so, and maybe it's because I have an engineering background, maybe it's because I'm an eldest child, maybe it's because I'm a Cherokee woman. I like to fix things. I love to daydream, and I love to work in a room and figure out, okay, this is the problem we have. How do we get around this? What's the best way? What are all the options? And if there's anything I can say about being in Hollywood that has really, you know, that I think is one of my greatest assets, is I've learned to build a good team based on the people that I know, right? The relationships I have built prior. and were able to, you know, I never want to be the smartest person in the room, not that I could ever try, but I definitely don't want to be that person. If I'm not learning, I'm not growing. And so, you know, as an arts administrator now, as a producer, director, you know, playwright, I find that's my greatest asset. And also, it was through those friendships and relationships that I was able to get parts with some amazing people. You know, I've worked with some pretty big names, which is very exciting. And because they knew me as, you know, Delana Studi, the person first,
right,
anytime I piped up with a suggestion or idea in the room or on set, they were open to hearing it, you know. Right. And I remember the first time that really happened for me was when I was working on ABC Hallmark's Dreamkeeper way back in the day. I think that was like 2003, 2004, so almost 20 years ago. And, you know, Steve Barron he was the director of the piece, and John Fusco, who's just a superb writer. I grew up watching John Fusco's films all the time. I loved that man so much. He shaped my childhood, if you will. And so to be able to work with these amazing people and be on set with them, there was a moment where my character Talks a Lot was supposed to interrupt like a council meeting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's a Kiowa woman, so she wasn't Cherokee, she was Kiowa. And, you know, from the Kiowa person I was talking to, you know, we were having these really amazing conversations, and I, out of curiosity, I said, would a woman do that? And if she did, would there be, like, any repercussions? And he was like, yeah, it's not normal for women to interrupt, you know, councils. And I was like, so would someone try to stop her? And he was like, yeah, I think so. So I remember just going to them and saying, hey, I was speaking to the consultant, Tanae Gigama, and this is what we were talking about, and these were the questions I asked, and I think someone would try to stop her. And so they're like, okay. And even though it was not scripted in the miniseries, they had a conversation, and the next thing you know, we filmed it that way, where we had someone try to stop my character from interrupting this male counsel, right? And the fact that they were just open to hearing that, and also open to trying it and seeing what happened, and the fact that it made the final cut. I mean, there's a good chance they could have filmed it and just did it to appease the actor, or just say no, period. But the fact that they not only took it into consideration, but, you know, they had those deep conversations, it made, you know, if you watch that film now, you'll see that moment. And, you know, I always jokingly say that created more work for me, and also more work for the person that played my mom. You know, that was just very exciting because she was in there a lot, and now she had a bigger part, you know, so it was, but you never know. And that was the thing, as my father said, you know, it's like, always ask. The worst thing they're going to say is no. And then the same thing happened when I was doing my first one-woman show, which was an Encompass Compassion play called Kick. It was through what was once called the NCCJ, which was the National Conference for Community and Justice. And then it went on to be called Encompass. And the playwright was the masterful Peter Howard, a non-Native person.
Nice.
But he had spent, I think 3 years interviewing like hundreds of people who dealt with the Native American mascot issue, especially in public schools. And but he wanted the character to be Cherokee. And so because of that, you know, he had hired a Cherokee consultant, an amazing person named John Orndorff, who came on. But, you know, John is also a Cherokee man, so his experience is different than mine. And so whenever I came on board, you know, I was able to bring a lot of the Cherokee language, a lot of some Cherokee music, some of the songs that my father had taught me when I was a little girl, and also a story about my grandma, which, you know, and I was able to share that with them, and then they asked permission if we could include it in the play, and so they did. And so, you know, it's always been that kind of experience for me where I get to go in and I get to, you know, they get to know me as a person, and they're excited to know about me, and I share, and then, of course, and I feel like some of them, especially the ones that pay attention, you know, they know when something's not quite off, so they'll come up to you and say, hey, how about this, you know, and like, is this ringing true to you, or do you think there's something we can do to fix it? And, you know, and then you offer a suggestion, and sometimes they run with it and sometimes they don't. But just being able to make those, I don't know, I now have the confidence to volunteer a lot of information. You know, if they take it, that's great. And, you know, and recently I've become a cultural liaison. A lot of people like to say consultant. I don't consider myself that. Usually what I do is I connect people to other people.
Right.
And because I've worked in the industry for a long time, I know how to kind of navigate the system so that the elders that I bring in don't feel like they're being taken advantage of. And I also guarantee that they don't be taken advantage of. And so, so I'm like, I have private conversations with them. And then, of course, we were able to go through there. But that's the other thing is I learned as a person that does that kind of work is sometimes there are people that want to hire you just so they can say they hired you to be the consultant.
Right.
Doesn't mean they're going to take your any advice. It doesn't mean that they're just going to say they hired somebody. They don't really want you to say anything, or if you do say anything, they're not going to listen to it. And then there are people that actually really want to work with you. They want the help. They need the help. They crave it. And it's always exciting when you get those people. And those are the people that I end up continuing on having a relationship with. And in some cases, I end up passing off that relationship. I've been hired to work on TV shows, and I'm like, I'm not the right person for this. But you know who is? I can pass you off to this person, and they'll take good care of you.
Nice.
So because I've already built that relationship, I also know that that person I'm passing them to is also going to be taken care of.
Right.
So it's a really interesting way of living my life. But at the same time, I also believe there's enough to go around, so I don't need to hoard all these opportunities, because there's so many other opportunities that are out there that were happening. And if I can't open doors for other people, then what am I doing with my life? You know, my next step is trying to figure out how do we take the door off the hinges so that way no one has to open it.
I like that. And, I just hear from you, there's a lot of respect and credibility with the work that you do. And you had the good fortune and blessings to have those experiences in the film, the entertainment media industry and in theater and arts. And do you find... between the two, that one is easier to navigate in terms of the work that you do over the other, or are they just different on their own terms?
I think they're all different on their own terms. It's nothing's ever easy. there are days where I feel like I'm getting ready to go to war every day, and sometimes I feel like I have to, but there are some days where the work, it just flows nicely, and you end the day and you're like, wow, if I would have told my 12-year-old self this is what I would do for a living, I'd be like, shut your mouth, you're lying. I have those moments where it's like, oh yeah, but it's always very fluid. It's never, the balance is there, but you have your ups and your downs. And
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. You're listening to our ongoing series, Sacred Stage, Talks with Native Playwrights and Artists with Delana Studi. She's speaking on the 30th anniversary of Native Voices at the Autry and the Generation Now Theater Project. All that and more here on American Indian Airwaves. And now back to the interview.
I've learned to navigate them. And now as an arts administrator, I feel like there are new ups and downs I'm learning to navigate, right? As an artist, there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that I'm not really privy to because other people are taking care of that. Now I'm the person that's taking care of that, so the artists don't know what's going on behind the scenes. To them, it runs very smoothly. And meanwhile, when you're the person that's up there, you realize it's not going smoothly at all. One of my coworkers made this amazing joke, and I love using it. Her name is Robin Hedrick. She's at the Autry, and but she always says, when people ask me what my job description is, I say I'm a firefighter, and all my coworkers are amateur arsonists. And to me, it's the funniest thing ever, because it's like, yeah, there are days where you feel like you're putting out fires. And I have to say, the managing director of Native Voices, Elisa Blanford, who is now like my best friend in the entire world. I feel like we share a brain just because we've been so entrenched together in, and growing Native Voices and taking on from where Gina Randy left off. She is the most expert firefighter. She's like putting out fires all the time. You don't even know those fires existed because you never see them, and she does it with such grace. I'm not quite there with doing it with grace. I feel like I come from the fire and I have ash all over me, and people are like, something just happened. I'm not going to ask what, though. But she comes out all glamorous and glorious, and you have no idea. So I'm still working on that. But, I feel like every new job comes with a new set of challenges, and how you learn to navigate those. And I think if there's anything I've learned since I've been doing this job in the industry, as you know, from starting off as an assistant director to actor to writer to producer to now running a native theater, is to allow myself that grace of not having to be perfect all the time and allowing myself what I like to call the luxury of failure, because I feel that's something people of color, you know, never get to have. Like, if, you know, for a very long time, if you messed up, you didn't just ruin that opportunity for you, you ruined it for everyone that was in your group, right? It's like, well, we know we're not going to work with them again. Those people are terrible. And it's like, no, you know, we have to have that luxury to fail and learn from those experiences and grow. So anytime I make a mistake, and let's be clear, I make plenty, but nothing is wasted. Like, every mistake is, it's a growing experience. It's a time for myself to show myself compassion, and to allow myself to grow and to learn from it. And so I'm getting, maybe it's old age, but I'm getting to the point where I'm actually more comfortable with that than I was when I was starting out. And I feel that's, you know, that's a grace that we need to afford ourselves, is we can't be on all the time, and we are going to stumble and we're going to fall. So how do we find, you know, how do we get up? And sometimes it's going to be graceful, and sometimes it's going to be not so pretty. And sometimes it's literally going to take someone else to come out and lend you a hand to help you get back up on your feet. And just learning that's part of the human experience. And so, yeah, so I think for me, it's, you know, just everything always has a new set of obstacles. I'm still learning. But then again, the day I stop learning, then it's the day I should move on and find something else to learn.
Well, speaking of new and learning and just listening to you share, you know, your work and lived experiences, do you have time to work on your own projects in between things?
I do. I mean, that's crazy. I know it's a luxury I don't have as much of as I used to back in the day. Uh-huh. Back in the day when I was a freelance artist, I had plenty of time. Right. And of course, you know, usually, because I feel like as an artist, as an actor or a playwright, it was always feast or famine. You would get like three job offers all at once. You can only choose one though, because they have conflicting dates. And then you would spend the next 6 months wondering if you're ever going to work again. And so, you know, so you would have time to like, either wallow in your self-pity that you're not working, or you could start, you know, doing a new project or creating your own. And so, and don't get me wrong, whenever I was in those 6 months period, it was a nice balance of self-pity and cleaning my house, finding a day job that I could respect myself over, and then of course finding time to write. And so I've learned to, you know, I've learned how to manage that. Right. What's interesting now, as an artistic director, my family was actually very worried, including my Uncle Wes and my Aunt Maura. They were terrified that once I became this, I wouldn't get any other artistic opportunities. I would be always working as the arts administrator / producer, and I would be growing as an artist. And, you know, if I can say anything about them, is they've always, you know, they've loved me, and they've always, they've been my biggest cheerleaders, and oftentimes they believed in me more than I believed in myself, you know? So to have them say that we think you're an artist and we don't want this to stifle your creative impulses or opportunities was a huge, it was a big deal for me, because it was like, oh my gosh, they really do believe in me. It's not, you know, it's not because I'm their, you know, their niece that they're trying to like build up my self-esteem. You know, it's like, they know, they actually believe that I have something to contribute, which is, you know, beautiful. But that was a big concern of mine. Once I became the artistic director of Native Voices, would I have time to do my own creative endeavors? And honestly, a lot of doors have opened up for me. You know, before I became artistic director, I'd already written a few plays. One has been on tour for like the past 5 years. I took this year off because my father passed, and the play is, I jokingly say it's a love song to my dad. It's about our experience walking the Trail of Tears together and me understanding who he was, because my father was also a boarding school survivor and an old speaker, meaning his first language was Cherokee. Mm. And so to learn about who he was as a young person, and also how we each deal with trauma in different ways, that's what the play was about. So this year I've taken it off, but I've written two other plays in that time frame. Wow. And because of that, I just became the resident playwright for Jiva Theater out of Rochester, New York, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
In fact, Jiva, I think my play Until We Walked was the first Native play they've ever produced on their main stage. And recently they, you know, one of the great perks of being, you know, a playwright in residence is they ask you for recommendations. And so I was able to put in front of them, you know, 3 to 4 different plays that I find exciting, that I love, and, you know, and out of those 4 plays, they chose one, and it's Vicky Ramirez's play, Pure Native, that was developed and produced by Native Voices, I want to say in 2018, maybe 2017, and it's going to be on their stage in 2025 in April, so they're going to do a second Native show, and so that's the great thing about, you know, they're going to commission me to write a new play, which is exciting. I've already had so many ideas, and I usually get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and start writing, and then my day at Native Voices starts. It's supposed to start at 9. Sometimes it starts earlier, but I try to keep a 9-to-5 schedule, except for when we're in production, and then it's all over the place. So I have to get my morning writing in, and, you know, the great thing about being the playwright in residence at Jiva's, I also get to put forth other Native people, which is exciting. Like, you know, I get to introduce other Native people to, you know, or Jiva to other Native playwrights. And so I'm already collecting my short list to give them for the next season. that's one of the perks. And then, of course, I have started doing a lot more writing residencies, which is great, because I can go elsewhere to start writing. Like this year, I went to New Harmony Project in New Harmony, Indiana, and I was able to get a lot of work done in the 2 weeks that I was there. And then, of course, I feel like there's something else. Oh, I'm going to be directing my my first play this fall for Perseverance.
Oh, nice.
It's a beautiful play by Kathy Tugnet Nolan called Cold Case. And so last year, Native Voices, we implemented our director mentorship program, and about how do we train directors to direct Native plays. And so I offered myself up as the guinea pig. We hired a director that we've worked with in the past on different projects outside of Native Voices, someone that I trust really well named Matthew Burgos. And he came in and he co-directed with me on Where the Summit Meets the Stars. And so I was able to get training from him on how to be a director, but I was also able to share the ways in which we do how we direct Indigenous pieces. More likely, since I'm not a director, I was able to talk about dramaturgical structure or lack thereof. Also, you know, how do we create culturally specific plays and maintain the fact that they are still culturally specific? We don't try to make them fit this idea of what the great American theater play should be. And so we were able to, it was an information exchange, if you will. And so it was through that process that that I was approached by Leslie Ishii, who is the artistic director of Perseverance, and she asked me if I could direct Cold Case. She wanted me to direct it last year, but I didn't think I had the experience. And then this year she asked me, and I said yes. And so I'll be directing my first solo play this year. So that's I'm always trying to learn something new. If I'm not living on the edge of anxiety, I don't know what to do with my life.
And as we wrap up the interview, where can our listeners go to get more information about the 30th anniversary of Native Voices at the Autry?
If you just do like a keyword search for Native Voices at the Autry or Native Voices Theater, it'll pop right up. But you can go to the Autry website, and we are listed there. We also have an Instagram page and a Facebook. I believe we're in the process of getting a TikTok. We have someone that does the social media for us, Jennifer Bobby Wash. God bless you. And the one thing you should know about Native Voices is we love Native artists in every way, shape, and form, and we want to find a way to promote and, you know, amplify as many voices as possible.
The moment of silence is over.
And we were speaking with Delana Studi, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, accomplished performer, storyteller, and playwright, and activist for over 25 years. She serves as the artistic director of Native Voices at the Autry, and she's been speaking on the 30th anniversary of Native Voices at the Autry and the Generation Now Theater Project.
That concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest, Delana Studi. A special thank you to our musical guest, Aragon Star, Koopa Aina, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
And for the innocent, you can't justify why your freedom manifests on their graves. And the blood never comes clean from the guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains. After all the lies and the empty promises, we take a stand on the land that you tried to bury us. For all the pain and all the suffering, we take a stand. We take a stand. We sleep caged against us.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September.